I'm so glad everybody's here today for our speaker that I'm very excited to have here for the first time at Westminster, Dr. Sally Satel. And I thought we'd start off with a couple announcements, and then I'd tell you a little bit about Sally, and then we'll have a short prayer. Next week, we're going to have a panel of people from Westminster and from outside Westminster talk to us about Moyes Bridge, where we've been, where we are, and where we might be. So I hope everybody will come and hear, multiple voices about Moyes Bridge, and I'm looking forward so much, having been there once myself, to hear what they have to say. Tomorrow night, of course, we're going to have dessert and dialogue with John Lewis and Fred, my husband, and they'll be talking about how their faith informs their public service. So you're welcome to bring your neighbors and your friends, and look forward to that evening. I'm looking forward to that evening because I'm sure I'll learn something new about Fred. So no pressure, Fred. So Dr. Satel is a psychiatrist who has a specialty in substance addiction. She's an AEI resident scholar, and she lectures at Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Satel has examined trends in medicine as well as national health policy. She has authored several books, most recently a book entitled Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. And the book was a finalist in the LA Times Book for Science. She works at the intersection of research, policy, and scholarship. Her clinical work with people primarily dealt with people with addiction and people with mental illness. And she continues to work to try and bring out into the open the many myths that surround these complicated conditions. She has initiated a new project surrounding the epidemic of opioids for AEI. Her project will try to document the evolution of the opioid crisis, especially the unintended consequences of various strategies, including the crackdown on painkiller, prescribing, the aggressive promotion of various anti-addiction meds, and how the synthetic opioids affect the epidemic's progression. We welcome you, Dr. Satel, to Westminster. Let us open with prayer. The Serenity Prayer is the common name for a prayer written by the American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. The best known form is, God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things that we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Dr. Satel.
Oh, yes. Okay. Because that you would say the Serenity Prayer because Alcoholics Anonymous has sort of adopted that as well. So I have an hour, right? About? Okay. And so I wanted to, didn't want to really talk for too long. I'm only going to talk for probably half the time because the questions are often the best part. But I thought I'd give you an overview of the situation, very briefly kind of how we got here and some of the unexpected developments. And then I hesitate to say what to do because no one knows quite what to do. There certainly is no single answer, whatever, but there are probably more promising strategies than others. So I will start, as all good think tank scholars begin, with a data slide. But there aren't many slides, actually. Basically, the point here is to show you the scope, the numerical scope, of the a crisis that is represented by drug overdose deaths. Obviously, more people use these substances than die from them. It's estimated about 2.5 million people have a serious problem with opioids. Now, opioids is a general class of drug that includes both. The old word was opiate. In fact, Marx even used that word, I guess, opiates of the masses. And opiates, for what it's worth, refers to anything that comes directly out of the poppy. So that would be opium itself, and morphine, which is actually also part of, easily extracted from the opium sap, codeine, and something called thebaine. But those are the pure opiates. And opioids, as the name implies, opiate-like, that includes most of the medications you would take, Percocet, hydrocodone, which are available in, you know, Vicodin, oxycodone and hydrocodone, which are available in Vicodin, Percocet, Lortab, those kinds of things. Oxycontin, which everyone's heard of, is a continuous form, hence the contin, form of, oxycodone. It's supposed to be available in the bloodstream for every 12 hours, and that's supposed to be its advantage. It's long-acting, so if a person's in pain, they don't have to keep taking medication throughout the day and have a fairly steady blood level. But anyway, you've heard a lot about OxyContin. That's specially prized by people who abuse drugs because it's pure oxycodone and it's high dose. And until 2010, it was fairly easy to smash up and inject or snort. Anyway, just in terms of identifying these drugs, and the synthetic opioids are methadone, and I work in a methadone clinic part-time. That's legal methadone. And then there's fentanyl, which is actually a legal painkiller, very effective, but it's also becoming more and more a drug of abuse. And that fentanyl, the illicit fentanyl, comes from China through Mexico. And that is actually, as you can see, that was just a sort of a lead up to this slide, as you can see that you see opioid painkillers are actually, well, this starts in 2015. If we went back to 1999, so you would see the painkiller, okay, that's the gray bar. You'd see that about down here. So this is where it is now. It's fourfold where it was, an increase in those deaths, fourfold since 1999. Actually starting to taper off a bit, or at least not increase that much, since about, again, I apologize, can't see that. About 2010 is when doctors finally started putting back on their fairly promiscuous prescribing. So the deaths from opioid painkillers are leveling off. And the last count, official count, this is not actually official. Those official numbers come out next month. But in 2015, which is the classic most recent tally, about 17,000 people died from painkiller overdoses. But now, ever since around 2010, heroin deaths, can't see it here, but heroin deaths started going up after 2010. And then around 2013-14, fentanyl deaths really started going up. And fentanyl is really what's causing the majority of opioid deaths. So the main point of the slide is that in 2015, 33,000 people died from an overdose of any kind of opioid. That number, when it comes out for 2016, next month, will probably be over 40,000. And the vast majority of those deaths will be accounted for by fentanyl. And fentanyl and heroin together, illicit drugs, the great majority, with opioid painkiller deaths leveling off. And that's very important because that gets to a lot of the policy making around prescribing. And maybe we're missing the boat a little bit if we focus too much on painkillers because that's coming down. But it's still important to pay attention to them as well. So anyway, that's where we are now. The numbers are only getting worse in terms of overdose deaths. So this is clearly a big problem. You could even say it's an overdose epidemic more than an opioid epidemic. This is important. And I keep mentioning fentanyl, fentanyl, fentanyl. If heroin is, that is heroin, fentanyl is 50 times as potent as heroin, which is why it counts for so many overdose deaths. I'm sure you're familiar with Narcan. That's the antidote that EMTs use. And in fact, now librarians are armed Narcan, naloxone, those are the same things. You spray it in someone's nose. And it would revive someone who overdosed on heroin, but you need multiple doses, sometimes 15, to revive people who are on, who have overdosed on fentanyl. And that you can imagine the expense of that, but you could also imagine how potent it is if it takes that much antidote. Naloxone basically just pushes the opioid molecule off the breathing center in the brainstem, because that's how people die from overdoses. It's respiratory suppression, and this medication can basically remove those molecules from the receptors in that area. However, they can be very tenacious, and they can be very potent with fentanyl, so it can take many more doses of naloxone. Then you get to carfentanil, which is an analog of fentanyl, also, and that has no legal function at all. Fentanyl actually, as I mentioned, is a fine painkiller. If you've had surgery and you have a pump, there's a good chance you'll be fentanyl in it. If you have chronic pain, there's fentanyl patches. It's a totally legitimate medication with good indication, but of course not to be abused. I forgot to mention another function of fentanyl is literally an elephant tranquilizer. It's mainly used by game wardens and zookeepers because that's a way to sedate animals. Carfentanil, which is an analog of fentanyl, both of them synthetic opioids, heroin being a semi-synthetic opioid, has absolutely no function at all, not in animals and certainly not in people. And it's about 5,000 times more potent than heroin. And that's creeping into the supply in some areas as well. Again, both of those coming from China, also through the dark web, people order it online as well. I don't mean your average person, but someone who is, you know, probably dealing can order it online. And the Postal Service is very much engaged with trying to intercept these things. So that's sort of a little bit of profile. I'm sure you've all read these stories about foster care systems being overwhelmed with opioid orphans, grandparents raising their grandkids, coroner's offices having to get refrigerated vans in their parking lots because they can't contain the bodies anymore. Some states have exhausted their funeral benefits that they, you know, subsidize people's benefits because so many people are dying. So on a lot of metrics, it really is a quite impressive and frightening problem that now is being driven by these synthetic opioids. So how did we get here? It's never just one thing, but the basic streamlined narrative is that physicians did have an inadvertent role in this. You know, in the 80s, sometime during the 80s, a movement to treat pain more effectively was starting to gain momentum among physicians. And it was true that pain was undertreated. Certainly people with cancer pain, even some of them were probably not treated as well as they should have been, but it was always understood that people with terminal conditions that were painful needed these kinds of medications, and there wasn't much hesitation around that. But there are other conditions where people are not, they're not terminal, but they're chronic, intensely painful conditions, and doctors needed, the patient groups and other advocates thought that doctors needed to pay more attention to this population. And they think that was true. I don't think anyone debates that there was under-treatment. And that movement really gained momentum in the early 90s when pain became, I think it was the National Pain, American Pain Association, argued for making pain a fifth vital sign after blood pressure, pulse, respiration, and heart rate, temperature, respiration, yeah, pulse, and heart rate, and a fifth vital sign now, which would be the extent to which someone had pain. Doctors were even rated on patient satisfaction with respect to how well they treated people's pain. So prescribing became much more liberal, not only for people with intense chronic pain, but also people with acute pain. At the same time, again, a lot of these things are happening at the same time. This drug OxyContin became available in 1996. And as I said, it was a very attractive drug of abuse because it was pure oxycodone at levels of 80 milligrams, even in 100 milligram pills. 100 milligrams of oxycodone, when you go to the dentist and get a few Percocet, well, if you get a few Percocet, you might get 30 days worth, which is inappropriate. But, you know, one Percocet tab either has 5 or 10 milligrams of OxyContin. And then the other part of it is acetaminophen, is Tylenol. But so that's 5 or 10 milligrams of oxycodone compared to 80 without the acetaminophen. When if you're taking them on a very regular basis, you don't want to take a lot of Tylenol. It's not good for your liver. So it really is sort of a dream drug for people who want to abuse these kinds of opioids. It's high dose. It's not added. There's no other medication with it, and it's all in one pill. So so the pain prescribing really did start to become too aggressive, and as I said, doctors faced pressure to prescribe. Insurance didn't really cover very well other alternatives for managing chronic pain, and doctors really aren't well trained in managing chronic pain at all either. I mean, there are different things people can do now, doctors can do for chronic pain. Maybe people will need less opioid medication, or maybe they wouldn't need it at all, depending on how well other kinds of non-addicting medications work, even some kinds of electrical implants, injections directly into the site. Other people talk about yoga and mindfulness. I think that can help. I can't imagine someone in excruciating pain finding total relief in that kind of a practice, but I'm sure it can help in managing anxiety. Anyway, there are other strategies, but doctors didn't know that much about them, and those that involved procedures weren't reimbursed often. And then there was, you've heard, of course, about the aggressive, somewhat aggressive marketing by the manufacturers of some drugs. Classically, it's Purdue Pharma that's getting a lot of the heat. If you want to read a great biography of the epidemic and how it began through excess prescribing of pills and then trafficking of black tar heroin from Mexico across the Mississippi, there's a book called Dreamland. I'm sure you've all heard of it. It's really quite good. It's a tour de force of reporting. Anyway, all these factors came together. And then there were pill mills. Now, folks heard of that, but they were in Ohio, Kentucky, Florida. These were pain clinics that were run by shady operators and manned by doctors who barely were hanging on to their license. And people would present with their pain and pay cash and walk off with a lot of pills and then often sell those pills for a dollar a milligram, which really adds up. In fact, another very interesting phenomenon that Sam Quinones, the author of Dreamland, describes is how there was almost what I call an oxyconomy, where people would get a hold of these pills and they'd pay their rent with them. Or they would go to, shoplift and then trade what they shoplifted for the pills. And this was a very vibrant underground economy. So that itself is extremely interesting. But in 2010, the pill mills, the DEA really started cracking down on the pill mills. And OxyContin was probably the most common pill they prescribed. So OxyContin became less available because of that, because Purdue Pharma reformulated it, meaning it was much harder to chop up and snort, and much less attractive. Very determined addicts can get around that. These are the greatest street pharmacologists you'll ever meet. But it was more arduous to disable the what's called an abuse deterrent formulation. And doctors started using prescription drug monitoring programs where they would keep a registry of who they prescribed drugs for, so pharmacists could check this to make sure people weren't doctor shopping, that kind of thing. And so there was more surveillance, and doctors were getting more savvy about the fact that we're probably prescribing way too many of these pills, which is not to say that they're not indicated for pain. It's just that, again, when you get your wisdom teeth out, you need two or three days worth, assuming it was an uncomplicated procedure. You don't need a month's worth. And that's really, I'm going to get back to that part, because that is extremely important in terms of who is using these medications. But just returning for one second to the notion that, you know, again, there started to be this crackdown in 2010. Well, it's kind of reflected. Oops, wanted to go back. And Mr. Buchanan has disappeared. Yeah. Well, if I went back to the slide, you again could see the heroin and fentanyl taking off. And it did bear some resemblance to, it did bear some temporal association to OxyContin becoming harder to get. I don't think that's the sole reason it took off. I think trafficking patterns had something to do with it in terms of the heroin. But there definitely is a noticeable increase in heroin overdoses as doctors started to crack down on drugs. It doesn't mean more people are using heroin. In fact, it's one of the, not so much a myth, but one of the things I about often hear is that when people can't get their OxyContin legitimately, they go on to heroin. That's not quite true. Very few people who abuse pills go on to heroin. It's just that because it's so deadly, the overdose rate has gone up. But that brings me to one of the more important issues of this, which is who is using these drugs? The implication from much that's in the news, kind of a narrative that has really taken hold, is that anyone in this room, or I should say everyone in this room, if they broke their ankle and were given a week's worth of Percocet, is at great risk for becoming addicted to it and then going on to heroin. And that's not quite right. The average person who is given a prescription for pain, an opioid for pain, will probably not even finish the bottle and not get in trouble with it. And so, as an aside, if you do have a painful acute temporary condition, do not be afraid to use these medications. But there is a subset of patients who would be more prone to abuse, and those are people with a history of alcoholism, previous drug abuse, depression, anxiety, or some other kind of psychiatric illness. That is a subset of people within the population of folks legitimately prescribed these medications who are at some risk. Again, they're not guaranteed to go on to have a problem, but they are at risk. And doctors have to know that. That's not a reason not to prescribe it, but that's something a doctor should know up front, and to monitor the person more carefully and to give smaller prescriptions each time. Although it seems that option's being not even left up to discretion anymore, as many states are now have passed laws about how many pills a doctor can give out at a first visit for someone with acute pain. And it's usually now between 3 and 7 days in many states. I mean, you can debate how much of an intrusion that is on medical practice, but in the end, it's certainly the right thing to do. Right thing to do, meaning to be much more conservative when prescribing at first. So I talked about the fact that doctors will tend to give, they're getting better, but a lot of them are still not there, why they shouldn't give lots of pills, a whole month's worth of pills to someone who has, let's say, a gallbladder operation and then goes home. And the reason is not because the person to whom they're prescribing those medications, as I just said, is at great risk. Oh, that's fine. You can leave it at that. But because when you hold on to those extras, and you're going to have a lot of extras, they basically feed the pool of these pills that are circulating already in the community. And those are the pills people are buying from each other. Those are the pills people are giving to their friends. Those become, even though they were legitimately prescribed, they sort of enter the gray market. They become the illegitimate supply for people whose primary purpose is abuse. So that's, so while I very much agree that doctors have to be much more conservative in their prescribing, it's not so much because the person for whom they're prescribing is at great risk. It's because having those pills and the risk of them getting out there is great, and that is the real risk that's posed. So, okay. So, all right, so we're at the point now where we kind of have a sense of sort of how this started, and since there are many strands of this, there's the prescribing strand, there's the, in a way, here we're at the supply side. I mean, this is the old dichotomy that's always been used for drug policy, demand reduction and supply reduction. So supply, again, is fentanyl from China, from the dark web, and doctor prescribing. Those are the main avenues of supply. And Mexican trafficking of heroin. Southeast Asia is no longer a significant supplier at all of heroin in the United States. So that's our supply reduction. Well, what about the demand reduction? Demand reduction refers obviously to people wanting less drugs, you know. And how do we get people to want less drugs? Well, of course, we think of treatment. So imagine this scenario. So you have someone who is overdosed in the library. It's very common. In fact, librarians talk about, you know, how they learn to distinguish the thuds, because people often go in bathrooms to do this. And now bathrooms are often locked, or they know, you know, they have someone watching the bathroom to see how long someone's in there, because if they're in there longer than a reasonable length of time, it's possible they overdosed. But apparently, if it's a quick thud, you've overdosed on fentanyl, because it's extremely fast acting. If it's a slow kind of scudding down the side of the wall, that's probably heroin, because it's a little less, it acts a little less quickly. I mean, these are morbid details that you don't ever really want to know, but that's, again, how commonplace this is. Well, anyway, so someone overdoses in the bathroom, the paramedics rush in. As I said, the librarians are, many of them are armed already with Narcan, so maybe they've tried to they've already applied a few doses, but again, if it's fentanyl, they probably didn't have enough on hand. Anyway, the emergency staff come and they revive the person, and then they want to take the person to the emergency room. And about half the time, according to a number of police departments, the person will just basically get up and walk away. They want nothing to do with going to the emergency room. They want nothing to do with drug treatment at that time. Now, to be fair, because these drugs, as I mentioned, of Narcan, I mean, you know, shoves the opioid molecule off the brainstem. Well, it also shoves it off the rest of the brain as well. And that means it's precipitated a very intense withdrawal episode. You know, and anyone who's seen Trainspotting, anyone who's seen any movie on that involves drugs has seen the cinematic portrayal of withdrawal, which is, and people just feel terrible. They're vomiting, diarrhea, shaky, agitated. And that's when you stop taking a drug and it comes on after a period of hours. Well, if it comes on like that, because these, as I said, Narcan shoves the molecules right off the brain, that is an intense withdrawal. So you can't even practically talk to someone when they're in that state. So it's almost understandable that they'd want to run out and use again to suppress that reaction, which is often typically what they do. But I think that was a big surprise to a lot of folks. I think they thought people who were revived would have, you know, an epiphany, like, oh my gosh, you know, literally a Lazarus-like phenomenon. I almost died. I really need help. This is terrible. I came so close to death. I talk about the ultimate wake-up call. And for some people, that is true, and they will say that. Wow, when they revived me, I realized how serious my problem was. But then again, there's this other big group that just, you know, runs out the door. Let's say, though, the person didn't run out the door, and they do go to the emergency room with the EMTs. Some states require it, others don't, that the person be transported. Anyway, they go to the hospital, they sit in the emergency room, and they bolt. So that's another link in this chain of where you can lose someone. They just walk out of the emergency room before they're seen, or maybe even after they're seen, but they just walk out anyway. And they walk out and almost assuredly, you know, use drugs again. Then you have the other scenario where the person went, you know, was revived, went with the EMT doc, went to the ER, sat there, met with the ER doc, took the referral for treatment, or even was walked over to the treatment center. Sometimes they'll actually do that. And then they drop out of the treatment center. So the attrition in treatment is quite high. It's about 60% within about between, you know, 4 and 6 months. And at least people usually need at least a year of drug treatment. So there's a lot of loss there. And I think, again, that surprised folks. Now, we have the strange paradox where there's certainly not enough drug treatment, but even when we do have it available, people don't always engage as productively in it as they should. Some do, but a lot don't. And I think that was also a big surprise to policymakers and health experts who don't specialize in addiction. So why do they run out? Well, I did mention the naloxone situation. I mean, they are in fluoride withdrawal. But even when a person isn't in withdrawal, you know, they've stabilized, then why do they leave programs? Why do they even walk out of the emergency room when they start feeling a little bit better? It's because there's enormous ambivalence that people have about giving up drugs. It's not to say they enjoy the life of being an addict by any means, and they've lost so much. But, there's a reason people do take drugs. And I'm a big believer in what you might call the self-medication hypothesis. But the idea is that there's, to put it in shorthand, there's just a lot of psychic pain. And people, after they've been using for quite, this is true of alcohol as well, but after people have been using for a while, they've got now a double layer of problems. They've got the problems that led them to want to basically anesthetize themselves in the first place, and then they've accumulated a whole second layer of consequences of lost jobs, lost relationships, health problems. They've damaged their future and trust people have in them. And confronting that unmedicated becomes a difficult thing to do. So it's really not that much of a surprise that people, a lot of folks are really reluctant to give up the drugs, even though, they've caused so much devastation because, you know, I guess economists would call this steep discounting, but, where your future self it becomes far less important than your current self. And a colleague of mine often says, no one wants to be a drug addict. Of course no one wants to be a drug addict, but that's not, let me back up. The person says that in response to challenges to how much choice people have in this matter. There's a big debate actually going on. This debate's been going on forever, you know, moral versus medical. I mean, we'd think we'd have exhausted that by now, because I think we've largely, you know, condemned the view that this is a moral failing or these are bad people. But there are choices involved. There's no question. And this particular person I debate with often believes there's no choice, that once someone's addicted, effectively their brain takes over and they become a zombie. And part of their argument is that no one chooses to become an addict. And I would agree with that, but that's not what people are choosing. They're choosing to feel better in the short term. And that would be true of anything. People don't choose to be poor. People don't choose to be, you know, overweight. But these are conditions that come on incrementally because in the short term, the food, the spending of money, the drugs make sense in the short term to that person. And that's why this is so, that's why these problems are so difficult to treat, but they are treatable and people get better. And so I want to move on to how they can get better, but a lot of it has to do with standing still. And if you're going to be bolting out of emergency rooms, bolting out of treatment, you're not standing still. And that is a big challenge. And one of the ways that systems are trying to deal with that is to, for example, assign recovery coaches to people who are in emergency rooms. These are people who are recovering addicts themselves, who can presumably develop somewhat of a better rapport with the person and tries to encourage them to go into treatment, or if the person insists on leaving, we'll visit them in their house soon. Yes?
You keep using the word treatment.
Mm-hmm. What is it?
Treatment includes a whole umbrella of things.
Mm-hmm.
These rehabs that advertise and whatever 28-day program, they don't work.
Yeah.
People come out after 28 days, and they're right back where they were.
A lot of them are. No, that's true. They're not well. A lot of treatment is not well done. So I think I'm just about to get to that, and maybe I'll just launch into that right now. I was talking about ways to get people to stand still, and I'm getting to that. So one way that people are trying now is again with these coaches. But to go into a treatment program, how do they get them there? So what is, that's a larger question of what is treatment. Opioid addiction is the only drug for which we have medical treatment. I'll get to the 28-day thing in a second. And what I mean by medical treatment, the old standby is methadone, of course. I'm sure you've all heard of that. It's been around since the 60s. And in fact, Richard Nixon was a great advocate of methadone in the 1970s. He was afraid that Vietnam veterans who became addicted to heroin in Southeast Asia would bring their habits back with them. And they actually, very few of them did, which is a fascinating story in and of itself. Goes to show you that when environments change, when context changes, people's desire for drugs often change. But methadone is a replacement opioid. It's an opioid itself. In fact, it's synthetic. As I said, I work in a methadone clinic. You take one dose a day. They give it to you in the clinic. They observe you. And some people are on it for a few years. Some people are on it for a long time. The average age in my clinic is 57. It's in inner city D.C., and a lot of these folks are what I call old school addicts. They kind of started with heroin. Today, more people start with pills who've gone on to heroin. Many of the majority started with pills as their first. Anyway, so methadone is a replacement drug. It completely obliterates withdrawal and it suppresses drug craving. There's another medication called buprenorphine, Suboxone, which people can get as an outpatient. It basically does much of the same thing. It hasn't worked as well in the outpatient setting as people hoped because, again, a lot of these folks will continue to use other drugs, and it's hard for a primary care doc to get urine tests, and they have to be observed urine tests. It's also hard for them to arrange counseling, so that hasn't worked as well as it could. But buprenorphine is a fine drug, and if people have these other supports, it's very good. Now, as far as inpatient goes, some people need a detox in an enclosed setting because it's such a destabilizing thing to just stop heroin that sometimes you need to be in a setting where you literally can't run away, and there are other medications like Valium-type drugs you can give to calm people down. And then it's over in a week. The withdrawal is largely over in 5 to 7 days. But then you've got the problem of what to do now, because as you say, that's a very tricky time, and most people will just go back to using after 7 days. 28-day programs are, they're problematic. They're incredibly expensive. And some of them are very, frankly, they're poorly run. I have nothing against AA, but that's not a treatment program. Anyone can and if it helps them, should go to AA on the outside. But what people need are extremely good cognitive behavioral therapies that teach them the kinds of things that trigger their craving, and help them deal with the craving, and also for a while, sometimes they just need to get the drugs out of their body. But they really, you know, need to start to learn these strategies in the very short term just for dealing with the craving, because they don't act on it. So, for example, if you have a job or if you get money from some source, never have cash on you. You have to give it to someone else. You have to have direct deposit. You have to alter the way you walk around your neighborhood so you don't pass by places you used to use drugs or obtain drugs. You can't interact with the same people. You have to build in all these barriers between you and the drug. And you know what? A lot of people have the ingenuity and the strength to do that on their own. Not everyone comes into a treatment program, and there's something called spontaneous recovery. But those who do obviously need more help in figuring out where their extreme vulnerable points are. And a lot of these programs don't do that. They just keep people housed for 28 days, and then you're released back to your old situation with their old environment, the old friends, all the familiar cues that stimulate craving all over again. And relapse is almost inevitable. And why it's especially dangerous is because if you've been off opioids for a while, you lose your tolerance to them, and then overdose is even more likely. So most people should be treated as outpatients, and especially if these drugs are going to be used. Because, again, these medications, but drugs, now I'm referring to the methadone or, I know you have to go, thank you, or methadone or buprenorphine, they are very stabilizing. They do, you won't withdraw if you're on them, and you won't crave if you're on them. And then you have to fix your life. That's the point of standing still, so that you can work on everything else. You can work on getting your kids back. You can work on getting the trust of your family back. You can come up with a payment plan for all the utilities that you didn't pay. I mean, that's a lot of, it sounds like social work, and a lot of it is, but that really is the way to start giving people some sort of sense that they can climb out of this, and help them with their relationships, because help them with all the things that cause anxiety in their life, because their typical response to anxiety is to use drugs. And so they have to learn how to deal with anxiety better, how to cope with craving better, how to recognize the kinds of cues that set them off. And that's a fair amount of work. It can be done outpatient, and in a way it should be done outpatient, but you don't see someone once a week at first. You have to see them almost every other day. I don't know that our system can afford this level of intensity of care, but you really need that kind of thing. Because when people are out in the community, then they can be challenged with what makes them vulnerable. They've learned some skills. They can apply them. Or maybe they slip. It's not the end of the world. It could be if they get fentanyl. But, you know, if one has a slip, theoretically, it's not the end of the world. It's information. You know, what happened? Why did you get in that vulnerable situation? And how could you have handled it differently? You can't do that inpatient. So that gentleman was right when he mentioned the 28 days. So I'm tempted to just stop here because I think we have to end in about 10. Is that true? Oh, okay. And I'm just going to turn over questions at this point.